You're listening to the Laugh Factory Podcast Network. For more shows, visit the podcast page at laughfactory.com.
It's the After Laugh, After Laugh. Welcome to the After Laugh, After Laugh, After Laugh. After Laugh, man. Go ahead, pull up
a
chair.
Hey, guys, welcome to the After Laugh. I have my new Focusrite mixer here. And I'm with my friend, my new friend, Dana May.
Yeah,
I feel like there should be more to the name than Dana May.
Dana May.
I feel like you should have I feel like you're like a three-name person.
Dana Dingleberry May.
What's your middle name?
May? Yeah, it's my middle name.
What's your last name?
Jameson.
Oh, Jameson, that's right. Dana May Jameson.
How good is that? It just rolls off the
tongue. Dana May Jameson. Yeah, that is like the sound of like...
Heaven.
Like the queen of the white trash ball or or English
royalty.
You're not part of the Jameson family, right? No. I don't know, whatever that means.
The Jameson family?
Oh, yeah.
No, I'm a part of the Jameson family.
Now, do you have any family in the business at all?
No,
neither do I.
No.
So let's introduce Dana May. Dana May, we did a... I guess you could call it a movie. Look, if we can't, we're going to talk shit, okay?
We can talk the poop. I just may have to flush it once the movie comes out and they listen to this.
So, no, everyone there was great. It was one of those, it was like a perfect storm of shit.
Well, you were there for a couple of days.
Yeah, I wasn't there. I didn't experience the whole thing.
You didn't experience all the shit.
Yes, you're right.
Just like a little tiny taste
of it. I felt like I came in. So let me tell you, I think I told you this, how I got involved. So Callie Norton, she's like been my best friend for like 25 years. She's like my sister.
Have you slept with her?
No. It's so funny. People always ask that.
No, I'm not.
We haven't even kissed or nothing. No.
Oh, that's sweet.
We were roommates, nice. and it was just like, that was our dynamic, and then we were just homies, and then there was a point where we were like, we just know everything about each other, so we should just be friends.
Yeah.
No, but it never had that vibe. I don't know. It just was, we were always just like brother-sisterly. I mean, we're very similar. We're both like overgrown children, and we like to play more than we like to work.
Yeah, she was wonderful. I really liked
her. She's great. So she's like, I feel like she's my sister. Anyway, so... I haven't seen her months. So she goes, oh, I'm doing this, I'm traveling to Thailand, I'm doing this. And also I'm doing this film, Couples Retreat 2.
What?
Did I tell you this story?
What? No.
Okay, she goes, I'm doing Couples Retreat 2. And I go, you mean a sequel to Couples Retreat? I go, wow. And I go, how are you involved with that? She goes, I know the producer. Now, it is not uncommon for people to be friends with investors or producers and get like a line or two in a studio film.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you see little people like, hey, well, here's your towel, sir.
Right.
And they're
they're
like the investor's son.
Yeah.
So I thought it was a little nepo situation going on. I'm like, oh, she knows she's tight with the producer. I was like, oh my God, that's so cool. I would love to do something like that. Just like have a like, she was, well, they're still looking for my husband. I go, could you talk to him? And so Callie says, this is so funny, Callie says, yeah, they know your work, they want to use you. And I'm like, oh my God, the producer for Couples Retreat 2 knows my work and wants to use me. And then I get a call from Vincent, who is the writer, producer,
executive producer of
this movie. Correct. Which is called Christmas Couples Retreat.
Christmas Couples Retreat 1.
At which point I realized it wasn't Couples Retreat 2. It wasn't Vince Vaughn.
Sounds exciting.
But
yeah.
Now I'm in.
Yeah.
And I know Vincent. So I was like, he's like, hey, we want to do this thing. We're going to add this thing where your car breaks down. You show up. You kind of crash it, blah, blah, blah. Can you write out like a storyline for this couple? Because you write, Bill. So I was like, I'm all for it. So I talked to the director. We came in like, this is going to be so fun. We'll improv. And we walked onto set the first day. You'd been on set for what, a week?
Oh, 2 weeks? Gosh. No, we did the whole thing in like 9 days.
So you've been on set for like 4 days maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was literally like you walk into a room after like a couple had a fight.
Yeah. Oh my God. Which moment did you walk in?
I don't remember, but I think it was like the day after you had your thing, which you can talk about.
Which thing? Okay.
or the day or two, but it was definitely, we walked into a room where immediately, I mean, Callie doesn't know this because she's never been on a set, but I walk in going like, I walked into something here. Yeah. I don't know, because Jimmy,
quiet on the set.
Jimmy Clavitz, who's coming, who's going to do my podcast later, nice. Who's great. He had this like, he was like staring daggers at me for no reason. I didn't even know the guy. They're like, shh, be quiet. And I was like, Jesus, what's happening? Oh, look yeah. around, and there's this weird tense
energy,
atmosphere, yeah. and the director sees me. He's kind of like, gives me a little head nod. I'm like, right away, I'm like, they don't want.
Who is this dude? Who are these people? Yeah. I mean, it was just
because,
very confusing.
So anyway, that was my experience. Mm. And then when we got there, basically this guy, Vincent, trying to do a favor to Callie, try to shoehorn her into this script that had been written with main characters or developed. And he was trying to shoehorn this in. And the director was like, I don't know what the fuck is going on.
Yeah.
So, and then they just didn't have the time or wherewithal to write in a storyline for us.
Yeah, so we were so behind on schedule. I mean, how can
you? So, what's your experience? Now, break it down. So, first of all, I want to back up a little bit. You are a multi-talented woman.
Who?
You are an athlete.
Yeah.
You are an actress, model, writer, dancer, singer.
No, I'm not a singer.
Oh, you're not a singer.
Not a singer.
But yeah, you have a lot. You have a lot going on. So, So before getting to the demise of Christmas Couples Retreat, I'm just going. Let's just back up. Introduce yourself to people a little bit. Let them know what your story is.
So I'm Dana Mae Jamison, J-A-M-I-S-O-N. It's me. I'm from Delaware. I've been in L.A. for maybe, oh, God, an eternity. Like 12, 13 years on and off. I've traveled a lot.
Yes, you're a traveler.
A lot. Yeah, I actually had my travel show that I was just pitching.
You were just pitching?
I was just pitching
in
it.
In Austin?
Yeah. Host, produce.
And how'd the pitch go?
Amazing. Amazing. I have options, which is wonderful. I'm not sure which network to go with.
So, people who don't know, pitching is basically getting an idea for a show.
Yeah.
And it's supposed to be original. And then you go to group of people who have money, production companies or producers,
networks.
Independent or networks, or whatever it is, which can be arranged either independently or through an agency or a management company, whatever. Mm-hmm. And you go, you guys are going to love it.
You're going to love it.
And there are some people, I mean, it's literally what you think it is. Like if you ever watch Shark Tank, sometimes it's like that cheesy. People
what it felt like. Actually, I said that while I was there.
You did?
Yeah. But I mean, it was so, I think, refreshing for people to meet me because I feel like everybody was super scripted. I felt like, like I did not belong there, almost.
So walk us through. So you have this idea. So
from inception to now.
So you were like you're a traveler. You're like, I should make money doing what I love.
Yeah, right? I didn't even think about that, honestly. Now I'm like, okay, I should probably take care of myself because I've invested so much of my money in this.
Yeah.
And my production company, but which is Soul Good Media, and it's a nonprofit too because it's badass. So what it is like is you go with an idea, but for me, I didn't just have an idea. I have an episode already filmed. I went to Italy and filmed the whole episode.
So back up a little bit. So when you, because obviously everyone in the world wants to create, whether they're, you know, working at Kinko's in Topeka right now, everyone has ideas for inventions or idea this or that shows. So to go from idea to shooting it, what was that like? What was that process?
Oh, that was me. You know, I didn't even know how I would find the money or the partnerships in what I wanted to do. I just looked at my dad one day and I was like, I'm going to create this. I'm not going to wait around for money. I'm not going to wait around for people to say yes. I'm going to just start doing it. And when I made that decision, literally every single person, the money, the people, the opportunities, the experiences that I was going to go on, like everything fell into place. It was the perfect life lesson for me. If you want to do something, just start doing it and the right people will come.
Well, let's get more specific. So when did the idea,
I've wanted to do this for like 10 years. Yeah.
And the idea, because to separate from another travel show, what makes yours special and different is what?
Mine's all about the heart and soul. It's like going to a country and finding the heart and soul of a country,
like what
the
makes
people,
that country
the experiences,
gives it its unique personality.
Yeah, and like the ways we can heal together in community, coming together, getting the wisdom from our elders. So I go to a different blue zone every episode.
Now, do you go to spiritual centers or is it food?
It depends.
It depends.
So the main thing is I go to a different blue zone every country.
What is a blue zone again?
A blue zone is the healthiest, happiest, longest living people that exist on the planet.
And how do you find that go to blue BlueZone.com or was it?
Yeah, yeah. Really? You can just look it up, Blue Zones. Yeah, there are five locations. Costa Rica, Greece, Japan, Italy, Sardinia, and then in America, in California, Loma Linda, which is crazy.
Where the fuck is Loma Linda?
It's in the San Bernardino County. I don't know. It's close, but I've never been
there.
Isn't
San Bernardino like right here?
It's here. It's here. They're here.
Everyone just lives, is this rich?
Yeah, no, they're just like enriched and they're joyful and they're happy and they're like 106 years old. It's like the oldest people that exist. So what I did was I went to Sardinia, which is one of the blue zones in Italy. And
now
I got
the money for Sardinia, I mean, did you have to pitch to investors and production companies?
No, I spent my own money. I collaborated with my partner. I had another investor and we were able to collaborate too with this, it's called In Me Wellness. A girlfriend of mine started a wellness retreat out there where she pulls in from South America, the most ancient tribes that exist today and have existed for thousands of years. And so she collaborates with the top of the top as far as shamans and healers. And so she brought out, knowing the show was going to happen, as many people, not even shamans and healers, doctors, facilitators, integrators, scientists, like everybody to back the reasoning for plant medicine, why it's so powerful.
And so the mission is basically a mission to share with people, look, these blue zones in aggregate have some sort of secret about happiness and longevity.
Yeah.
And I'm going to try to relay that to you with this show.
Yeah, that's like one portion, but it's more about like the soul, like how we can come together and heal. And as far as like how I think healing goes is I want to find the wisdom in the world. I want to find like those golden nuggets, and the people that I think would have them are our elders.
Sure.
And the healers and the shamans and the people that don't do it for the fame or like the platform that deserve it.
Yeah.
But yeah, getting the wisdom from these people. It's like the search for soul. So it's getting rid of all of like the Western ideas of like accumulating all these things and doing and having to prove yourself. And like, how can we slow down and get more connected with our hearts?
Sure.
And live from that space because we're fucking lost. Shit's been hard. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no better time for healing than right now.
Were you motivated by, I'm not motivated, but was it COVID that made you kind of
COVID definitely put it in perspective for me. I definitely was like, wow, we are all in deep need on a global level of healing and coming together in community, having these masks on, like psychological ones, physical ones. It's like losing that connection with each other. And we need to touch each other. We need to come together. And we've lost so much of that in the West. And it's I feel like we've lost sight of ourselves and our souls. So it's called The Search for Soul.
The Search for Soul is the series.
Yeah.
And you shot one episode.
Yeah.
Was there ever a moment either on the plane ride where you're like, what the fuck am I doing? Like, am I above my head? Is this, or were you just like single?
When I sat in ayahuasca,
like, I'm doing it.
When I sat with ayahuasca,
let's talk about ayahuasca. Cause I've never really talked to people on this podcast about ayahuasca. People who listen to it know that I'm a big fan of mushrooms.
Oh my God. Just as powerful. Mushrooms. All psychedelics. It's like the revolution happening right
now. But ayahuasca I have not experienced yet. And I'm dying to. Look at everything else. Every level, there's always like fear, right?
Yeah,
the fear for weed is that you're going to have no memory. You're going to be brain dead. You're going to like whatever. Like you're going to be impotent. Lose your testosterone. There's all sorts of shit. And then for mushrooms, it's like, you're going to have a bad trip and never come down.
Yeah, LSD. I have friends that have experienced that.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
They feel like they're never the same?
Yes, it took them a long time because they were, I mean, I feel like we're never going to face anything with the medicine that we're not capable of handling.
Yes.
And going through. The universe is never going to give you anything that you're not capable of going through. But I do have friends that were confronted with parts of themselves that really were traumatizing, and they didn't have a way to integrate it afterwards or to talk to somebody. They didn't have therapy.
You're talking about psilocybin.
Mushrooms, yeah. Yeah.
Interesting.
So with ayahuasca, I think the main point is it's not just the medicine, but I think who is facilitating it and how it is being shared, knowing where it's coming from, your connection to plants in general prior to, your connection to the earth prior to, and your respect for it, going in, who's doing it is so important, because people in California are like, oh, I'm doing these ayahuasca ceremonies, you should come join. And what I experienced out there with this tribe from Colombia.
And where was this tribe?
This tribe was
after Sardinia. You went to...
It was actually before. So in Italy, we brought the Inga tribe from Colombia. It's the most ancient tribe that exists there. And we brought the shamans from there, shamans who have taking the medicine.
You flew him to Italy.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And they've been taking the medicine since they were 8 years old. Like it's their purpose, it's their calling, and it is so transparently clear.
So when you're around these people who've been doing it since they're eight,
yeah,
do you immediately get a sense of that they have a clarity
and a sense
of purpose and joy that we just don't have?
They are literally living, breathing, just incredible humans in their joy.
Yeah.
It's like their light. And yeah. I'm like, those are the types of people I want to A, be around, but B, also trust in this kind of space with this medicine. So it's not just the people that are facilitating, it's also the integration after it.
Sure.
It's because you're going with this new, like you come out of it with this new lens and this new perspective on life, and you're going back into the same energy. You're going back to your community in the same energy that exists there, but you're different.
Yes.
So it's like integration is so
important. And people don't like that.
No, of course. Your friendships are, my relationship blew up when I got back home.
Oh, so you were in
my
a relationship and when you got back,
yes.
You were like,
everything, everything
okay,
shifted.
Okay, so let's be specific about that. I like the foreplay, okay? So you had the ayahuasca.
Yes.
You'd never done it before, right? Mm-hmm. And you're with like the OGs of ayahuasca.
Yes, yes.
Right? And is it a three-day ceremony?
It was a two-day.
Two-day
we
ceremony.
We did it twice, yeah.
Are you puking a lot during this?
I didn't puke at all.
Because you're so clean and pure.
Oh, no, I almost vomited, like projectile vomited
my
healing.
I know I'm going to puke a lot.
Yeah, and you know what? It's energetic, actually. When people puke, it's not, they're nauseous. It's actually, they're releasing a lot of energy.
Yeah, yeah. That's one
what
way
they
put
say.
It.
Yeah, so you would be vomiting aggressively.
Yes, I definitely would be vomiting. I know I have a lot of shit I got to purge out.
Yeah.
So I've been a little scared off, not because I'm worried about puking, but just I don't know. It's a little bit like, you know, the sliding glass door into my brain. Like sometimes I'm like, just fucking keep it shut. I don't know if I want to know everything.
Of course,
I don't really feel
do.
That way. But there's fear. But there should be fear.
Yeah, right.
And then you just conquer it. The courage is conquering something that you're afraid of. Anyway, I will do it at some point. I keep going like, well, when the universe wants me to, I'll be led there. And
that's
right
kind of what happened to me. And I ended up sitting with the same tribe that I wanted to sit with.
So when you started
anyways.
This, you didn't think you were going to be doing ayahuasca.
I had really wanted to, and I had already prior to this, I wanted to do it with my brother. And so I looked up tribes. I looked up who I would want to sit with my brother. And this tribe was actually the tribe I wanted to sit with years ago with my brother. And then that ended up being who I sat with in Italy,
wow.
Which is wild and amazing. But it was also like, I felt the calling. I was like, I really do want to sit with this.
Yeah.
What was the question?
So you did the 2 days. You said you weren't puking.
Mm-mm.
Was it terrifying at any point? Did you feel it was just sort of introspective? Were there moments where like the demons are coming out at you with the fangs and the claws, or was it more of a peaceful, gentle thing? And at the end, what would you say is the sort of palpable realization or revelation you had about yourself and the world and life? A lot of people I know say,
we're all siblings.
Everyone in the world is siblings.
We're all siblings.
And also that you lose your fear of death, apparently, a lot of
people.
Oh,
all of it. All of it. It's like so much clarity. But for me, it was like that really deep knowing that we're all siblings and we're all family.
Yeah.
Like, and to be in a community of people doing it, I thought I was going there for my own personal healing, and it was like we all healed together.
Collectively, interesting.
It was wild. Like, it's like the veil comes up when you do ayahuasca, and you are instantly connected to every single person around you. So mm-hmm. everybody within this tribe, you get these individual healings. So you hear people go up with these healers, and they're purging, and they're crying, and they're shaking, and they're throwing up, and whatever. Like, you see the healers putting their hands on different parts of people's bodies, and people are releasing in some sort of a physical way.
Wow.
And you're feeling it. And sometimes when you hear other people crying, it you start crying, and like their healing becomes your healing.
How big was the group?
There's about 30 people there,
30 people,
including the doctors, including the scientists, the integrators. Everybody was doing it.
Yeah.
Which I think is really amazing.
And this is your whole crew? Did you collect this group?
No. This was In Me Wellness. This was my girlfriend Anastasia. this was all of her people, but it was cool because it was people from all over the world coming together.
But you weren't filming it as part of your documentary, correct?
We filmed almost every part of it,
except
for the actual like in ceremony, just in respect to the medicine and to the shamans and to the participants. Plus, it's at night, and honestly, I was like fucking plowed down into the ground like a grilled cheese. You couldn't even pull me out. I couldn't get any further into the ground.
Yeah,
I was in it. I was in it, and I was wearing a diaper because I'm a responsible adult, just in case.
Are you supposed to wear a diaper?
No. No, but I...
You're like, I'm going to pee, but I'm going to shit.
Yeah, if I shit, it's going to be in this baby. And like, yeah, no, I didn't, which is great. But I did get my period. With this tribe, you're not allowed to be on your period at all. Like spotting nothing, because your energy as a woman when you're on your period is so potent and intense that it could hurt the shaman and this shaman specifically. So here's what's crazy. I got my period way late and it was like I was still spotting, and then the next day was when I was going into ceremony, and so I was trying to wait it out and I was like so conflicted. My whole production team came out. I'm supposed to do ayahuasca for the show, and I'm like suddenly conflicted with, do I do this? Do I lie? Do I come forward? Like the whole show is like about honoring these traditions and these people and these tribes and the wisdom, and who am I to lie about something like this? So I was a hot mess.
Yeah.
And then it comes down to the day and I had like a conversation with myself, because I'm like, you know what? I'm listening to all the advice, the wisdom of people, and they're like, trust your body, trust your body. So I tapped in and I was like, I'm not on my period anymore. I know I'm not. And so I went into ceremony, and there was a point where this the whole tribe started playing this crazy tribal music, and it was intense. And without them saying it, everybody knew, because the veils come up, that they were saying, whoever is on their period, you have to come forward now. Yeah.
The drums told you that.
The intensity of it, the way that they were chanting, like everything about it was like, it was so clear to me.
Wow.
And so Anastasia, she knew that I was going through this. And so she ran up to me and she was like, Dana, if you're on your period, you have to get out of here. Like, this is going to hurt the shaman. This is very important. And I was like in my diaper, plowed down on the ground. And I was like, I'm not on my period. And then I was like, shit, am I on my period? And so I like eventually got up in my fucking diaper and like waddled to the bathroom, and I didn't know which way was up. And I tried to walk up a wall and I was like, it's not that way. Then I finally got in the bathroom and I pulled my diaper down and I wasn't bleeding. So I was like, yes. So I baby crawled back to the space, and it ended up being her sister.
Oh, wow.
Anastasia's sister that was there. But it was like,
did she come forward or
she did? Yeah. They had to have that person come forward. And so she was put outside next to the fire.
Shame.
But imagine that.
Shame.
I went through a whole spiraling thing about, that's like, wild. Am I being a coward? Like, what am I? That's I'm supposed crazy. I'm here to like trust my body, respect these people. And it was the drama for me. That was so intense. But it taught me a lot about courage and self-respect, and also just respect for the tribes.
Yeah interesting.
Yeah,
so you shot it all, and the episode is just in Sardinia, right? So you're
it's in Lake Orta and Sardinia.
Okay.
Yeah. Lake Orta was the retreat, and then Sardinia was
If you were to leave with an elevator pitch about what you learned from the Sardinia experience in the Blue Zone in terms of like clues to living a more enriched life.
Yeah.
What would you say you found?
So what I thought was fascinating was all of us coming together in Lake Orta for this medicine and this experience. We're coming from all over the world and doing this medicine and getting these messages all together. And then I go to Sardinia, where these people are living happy, joyful lives. They've never even left their villages.
Wow.
And they're all the same messages. It's like prayer, gratitude, honoring the earth, honoring your bodies, honoring what you put into your body, the way that you eat, how you love, how you wake up in the morning. It's like it's the most simplistic things in life that we forget about.
Yeah.
Like our breath.
Yeah.
Our gratitude, just to be in the moment, presence. Like it's so simple, but we forget that. And we're in our minds, and it's like, how can we get more connected with our hearts and our bodies? And they're just the same messages.
Mm-hmm.
And to see them live by that is a totally different thing.
Yeah.
You know, because it really shows. They're just so joyful and present.
Yeah.
And they care.
That's very interesting.
Family was a big one in Sardinia.
For sure.
Yeah. And it was beautiful because the kids there, they love their elders, and you don't see a single nursing home. You walk into a bar and it's not pictures of celebrities, it's pictures of their elders.
Yeah.
They're like, you brought me into this world, I'll bring you out.
Yeah. And families live together. They live together like three generations. They're living
in the same
roof.
I stayed with a family that was three generations.
Yeah. Which is, in America, is
not unheard of.
White people in America, it doesn't happen.
Right.
You never see it. I've never seen
God,
it.
God, we have so much trauma.
Maybe in some like Mexican families or different families.
Yeah, right.
But I feel like, it's sort of, I don't know what that's really about. I think there's definitely like some sort of conflict between family and community and being American and forging ahead and manifest destiny and making your dreams come true. Because making your dreams come true and being part of a family, they can kind of run at odds, it seems, you know, particularly in places like fucking LA.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where, you know, you kind of have to be a sociopath to truly make it. But interesting, because you're also a comic.
Yeah.
And comedy isn't really about the art of complaining, but on one level, it is sort of reflecting back to people who come what you find absurd and dumb and silly and funny about society. And it seems like an attitude of gratitude, to use a cliche phrase.
I like it.
As a comic, can seem sort of, doesn't seem like it's going to be the funniest set in the world. If your set's about gratitude, it doesn't seem like you're going to make everyone laugh.
Yeah.
But if you're like, I'm a fucking piece of shit loser, and like, I want to kill myself, you're like, I'm giving you a special.
Guy.
Yeah.
That's so true. I feel like shit's shifting.
Have you tried to integrate sort of a
spiritual,
different framework with your comedy into your act?
You know, it's interesting. It's more about just like where I'm at in life, honestly. It's so therapeutic for me. But I do I like talking about, like, I am who I am. I am like a joyful, like, burst of sunshine most of the time. But I also come from a very dark past and a very difficult childhood with mental illness and physical illness. And all of that is what's made me who I am. So it's fun for me to talk about, like, my upbringing. I wish I could get more into that. More so than, like, how can we be a little lighter here, you know?
Yeah. Well, let's get into your dark, sordid past. That sounds fun. Because we grew up... Wait, where'd you grow up again?
Delaware.
I was in Virginia, so we were neighbors. So it's like Delaware.
Really?
All I know is the DuPonts and Biden.
Yeah.
I dated a DuPont at Princeton briefly.
Did you? Jeez.
But she was like... Basically, I'll fuck you, but like, we're not going to be a couple. You know that, right?
Wow.
You'll be my fuck boy, but I'm not going to. I'm a DuPont.
And you were like, okay.
And I was like, all right, sounds good to me. I don't want to marry you anyway, stupid. I'm a sophomore in college. Anyway, she's a nice lady. Leah Carpenter, good girl. Anyway, she's up too.
Hit her up.
No, we hung out, and then we kind of hung out in New York a little bit. I always had a big crush on her, but I don't know. It was just, she always had this feeling of like, I'm doing this because I need something right now.
That's always great to be on the other side
of. I can't seriously be with you, Bill. Yeah. Do you know how rich I am?
Oh, that's so lame.
I don't even know if it's like conscious, but I feel like there's this energy that I felt like. You know, I was like Patrick Swayze in Dirty Dancing. When the girl wants to go to the other side of the tracks. Anyway, so Delaware.
Uh-huh.
And we talked about this briefly. You were like a world-class athlete. You were a national...
Oh, yeah. I grew up a huge athlete. I was always trying to prove myself through my physical strength growing up with two brothers and feeling like just
a girl.
And you
two older brothers, right?
Two
older brothers, right.
Yeah.
And were they very athletic? And you were
I'm
going to show dad that I'm the best boy he has.
You want to wrestle? I drank my brother's creatine and would like pee like a boy. Like I didn't realize I was a girl until like a dude was inside of me. Actually, that's like normal, always.
Wait, what? You didn't know you're a girl until dude? Wait, hold on.
Wait, I don't know.
I have
a woman.
Type of input.
Until a man is
inside. You're like, oh.
Oh, right. Yeah. Oh, the vulnerability is real.
How old were you when you lost your V card?
I was the prime age
to your
of
mom and dad.
16.
I think that's fair. That's a
all
good
right,
age.
Maybe it was 15. I don't tell people that.
Could have been 14.
I wasn't ready. I don't like that. I felt rushed.
How do you teach young girls to like maintain the virginity as long as possible without feeling like...
Teach them self-respect. Is standing up for themselves and boundaries, really, is all it is. Because then they can decide when they are ready. And sometimes it's earlier, sometimes it's later. But for me, I wasn't ready. And I didn't have the boundaries. I was like, I think so, maybe. I was with my boyfriend.
We love each other.
Yeah, but I didn't want it. I didn't want it. I was like, ugh. Yeah, no. And I lost my virginity to a lava lamp, too. I was like, oh, I'm going to have to do this, but I don't want to be like a ugh about it.
What do you mean a lava lamp?
A lava
lamp. You lost your virginity to a lava lamp?
Well, it was the top of a lava lamp. I like lit a candle and played music and laid in my bed and was like, I don't want to do this with a guy, because every girl thinks that they're going to lose their virginity and it's going to hurt.
You use a lava lamp as a dildo? Is that what you're telling me?
I'm not a dildo. I wasn't getting off to it. I was just like, I don't want to lose my virginity and it hurts so bad with a guy.
God. So you wanted to bust your hymen with a prop.
Yeah, I think it was already busted though. I'm kidding.
From gymnastics and field hockey and track.
Yeah, I was a fucking athlete. I rode horses and shit.
Yeah, it was cool.
But like, I just didn't want to be like that girl. But anyway, lava lamp. It was
okay,
green.
So
it was green.
So far, it doesn't sound super dark.
I didn't sit on the whole thing.
It doesn't sound like a dark history.
Oh.
What do you feel is so dark about your past?
Oh, my dad was really sick my whole life.
Mentally or physically? Or
both. Yeah, had a stroke the year I was born, and so he was disabled growing up. And I dealt with just a lot of kids making fun of him and calling him retarded. And that's actually how you and I had our first conversation.
Yeah.
I heard you say retarded, and I was like, hey, don't use that word.
Got it,
and you were just talking about how people used to call you retarded.
Yeah.
And we talked about it. I was like, okay, I'm so sorry. I just like get so fucking triggered.
Sure, I get that.
But yeah, kids used to make fun of him because he would show up at every game alongside of like these kids never had their parents show up, like the kids that would actually make fun of him.
Of course.
He would show up to everything, no matter how he was feeling.
And was he in a wheelchair, crutches,
no,
or how did it manifest itself?
So he could, at the beginning of it was like really hard for him to walk and talk. I mean, he had really big issues, like, and especially when he would be in front of people, he would develop like a stutter, and it was just very difficult for him. Could barely walk and talk and was on so many pharmaceuticals. He was like a guinea pig for these doctors and just like pumped with
and
all
what
this
was,
shit.
What was the disease? It was
so when you have a stroke, it affects people differently, and his was just really bad. And it crippled him for like an emotionally just serious, like severe depression. Mm. And my dad is like my hero. I love him so much.
Yeah. And what was the cause of the stroke? Sorry to interrupt, but like,
we don't know. He had serious migraines since he was like 16.
Since he was 16.
And then he had this stroke in his 30s.
And is there a name of the stroke he had? Was it like a...
I don't know. I know there are a couple names, and I know one's worse than the other is the worst one.
Yeah.
But a lot of... I mean, the doctors told my mom that he may not ever come back.
He'd be a vegetable?
Not a vegetable, but he may not ever regain his speech or his physicality or...
Wow.
Yeah. And my mom is such a champion because she was like, through sickness and health, I love your father. He is a heart of gold. I'm the lucky one. She was like, I'm the lucky one. And she stood by him through everything.
That's so crazy.
And their relationship now is
so good.
So beautiful.
And how was your father? Did your father ever recover?
So about like 6 years ago, I have inspired him a lot to eat healthier, to say, fuck pharmaceuticals. You don't need to be on all of these antidepressants.
And
you
I'm
don't
sure
need to be on these blood.
Everything, right?
Everything and then some. And to watch him go through that as a child, to watch him that fucked up and that sad over everything, like not being able to recognize that he can heal his own body. And for me to be the one to tell him this, and not a single person in a fucking white coat has ever said, you have the power to heal your own body.
Of course not.
Unfucking believable. It like it, and that's another reason why I do the Search for Soul, all about healing and this and that, because like Western medicine is so fucked.
Yeah.
And to witness that as a kid in a family where we love, my dad is so amazing. He's so incredible. And my mom was with him through all of it, and I was with him through all of it. And so we're just so tight. Yeah. We have so much love for each other. And so to witness him go through that and then to also regain his health to a point where you wouldn't even be able to tell that he ever had a stroke.
Really?
Yeah. And so like 5 years ago, he got on his first flight since before his stroke. He came out to California to visit me. We had our first father-daughter trip together. We went skydiving out
what
of a fucking
fuck?
Plane.
That's amazing.
How cool is that? We've smoked weed together, mushrooms.
Oh
like
my God.
Like
you
we,
did mushrooms with
yes!
him?
Yes!
God, I would love
He's
to mushroom
amazing. amazing. And like his love for my mom. He's 65.
So he's young. That's
No. I'm sorry. My mom's 65. My dad's 71.
71. Okay, still fairly young. You know?
And he is the healthiest he's ever been.
That's amazing.
And so COVID was a blessing because I was back home and
you were able to help guide him?
Oh my God. I was like, my parents were like, get her out of the house. I was every morning juicing for them every morning because he had a health scare and like his blood pressure went from like high mm-hmm. to completely normal within 2 weeks of his little daughter.
What did you, because look, I have two parents that are down in Huntington Beach and they're fucking decrepit, fucking they eat like shit.
Yeah. Well, that's the problem. Diet.
I try to convince them of everything. You got to eat this. And they're always like, well, we don't care. We don't fucking give a shit.
And that's the problem if you don't care. My dad has always gotten to the point of like, I'll do anything. And that's why it's so fucked that these doctors would just give him more prescriptions. When really, if he could do anything, they should say, then change your diet. Stop eating shitty foods. I know you were raised like this. We were never told correctly. We're in America. No. Everything in the store is mainly poison for your body. Yeah. And so as soon as I got back home, I started giving him celery juice first thing in the morning. I waited 30 minutes. Then I would give him like a juice, like beets, carrots, parsley, greens, kale, all of the things.
So the first week is him just shitting his brains out. Right?
I guess it does do that.
Burgers from
really
20 years ago stuck in there.
Oh my fucking, it within less than 2 weeks, his blood pressure, the doctors were trying to put him on higher just doses of blood pressure medication. And I was like, Dad, fuck that. Just let me step in. And I have people in my family that are nurses.
He literally stopped taking those drugs at your best.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And he trusted me.
Yeah.
And I spent my whole COVID just researching all of it.
Yeah.
I have a whole book of his. I checked his blood pressure. I was like, Nurse Dana.
I want that book. Literally, I gotta get to my stupid parents.
Oh my God. It was so beautiful. It was so wonderful to witness him. And then he's cooking for my mom. He's taking care of my mom. And she's always been the one to do it for. It was just so beautiful to watch. Yeah. Yeah. It's really wonderful.
Yeah. And so I'm assuming he lost weight. His skin got better.
Yes. Yes.
And was there a moment where you felt like you cracked it? Like you felt like my dad's back or he's back? Was the moment he like woke up one day, it was like, fuck.
Well, watching him juice for my mom, cook for my mom, get up every day, excited to be alive. Like,
was it hard
I've never
for him to walk
him
before
like
this?
Before this, like a few years ago? No, but like he hides everything really well. Mm. But yeah, he's always had like a really bad lower back pain and I still need to like get more into that. Mm. But yeah, he can walk pretty normally. He has like a little bit of a hunch, but it's not anything like it used to be.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but he would still hobble down the sidelines every single game, shout out shit, not make any sense. And people would be like, who's this dude? My brothers would be like, Mom, get him out of here. And I'd be like, dude, embrace it, embrace it. It's challenging.
Yeah, for
Imagine
sure.
Imagine that.
For sure.
Yeah.
And your older brothers, what do they do? Where are they in the business?
My one brother, he was like scouted for the Phillies at one point. He was amazing. Athletes, he was throwing like 96 miles an hour at 16 years old.
Jesus.
Yeah, he was a beast. But he's like into carpentry, like does tiles and like physical labor stuff.
I like that.
Makes a good amount of
money
doing it. He lives in Delaware.
Okay, because I was like, maybe you can do my apartment.
I could fly him out here. and then my other brother, Ryan, he works for my uncle's company. They're both into like physical labor stuff.
Yeah,
like guys.
So you're the only one in the aughts.
Yeah.
So what made you decide to be a stand-up comic?
I think just like going through so much in my life, honestly.
You're like, I got to have some therapy and get paid for it.
Yeah, well, honestly, I used to go into school and like really sense the tension as like a little girl and know that like making people laugh eases the tension. Especially like with girls growing up, like it was really hard. It's hard for all the generations, but for me specifically, I just felt like I was just a girl. Like I was never seen as an equal. And that was very subconscious. I don't think that was ever like really projected onto me too intensely, or maybe it was actually.
Yeah. Maybe.
But to feel like just a girl and like all the girls in school always wearing makeup and wanting to be pretty and have big, like I dealt with that shit too. And I'm like, we can also just laugh. It feels so. I was class clown every year. Yeah. Because I'm like, it just feels good to be silly and be like, fuck this, all this bullshit. And I didn't know what that was, but I'm like, none of this is real.
Yeah.
So it was always like that way of like lightening up the tension.
Yeah. And so did that make you, at what point did that translate to going, hey, maybe I can do stand-up comedy and tell jokes on stage?
Right.
Or when did that come to your life? Because I feel like the story of how that comes into most comics' lives is always very unique and circumlocutious. It's never like some. It's very rare someone's like, I knew I wanted to be a stand-up at 15 because I saw Richard Pryor, and I went to my first open mic at 16 and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
It's usually people are like, I was an engineer, I got in a car wreck. And this is going to sound awful, mm-hmm. and I know I'm laughing, but like it's, I cannot tell you the amount of women who have been on this podcast who are like, well, I got in comedy because I got raped or I got assaulted.
Oh,
I'm like,
wow.
Jesus Christ. And that was the thing that kind of made them, I guess it made them look at whatever they were doing in their life. One was in the army, one was like a corporate thing, and just go, what the fuck am I doing with my life?
Huh.
I'm subjugating myself, putting myself in this position. I'm not getting respected. Even when I try to like tell people about what happened, they're not listening to me.
Oh, wow.
And it made them kind of like go, if it's all bullshit, then at least I'm going to have fun.
Yeah.
So I'm not saying that's why you got it. But I always feel like there's usually a precipitating moment for people that got in state. For me, I think it was just like someone got me drunk and forced me to an open mic.
Oh, wow.
You know.
Were you instantly good?
No, it was fucking terrible. Are you kidding me?
I was so bad. I mean, like...
Do you remember what you did your first set?
Oh, my God. I had a guitar, and I... I can't play guitar,
hey,
and I can't sing. And I made
That's
up
good.
This
the
song
guy,
that rhymed.
Do you tell a joke, it bombs, you just go back to playing the guitar, it doesn't really matter.
I just,
no
like, strummed it like I knew it.
And what did
like,
you... Do you remember anything you said?
Oh God! It was like, have you ever? It was like, have you ever? Then at that, me neither, sort of a thing. But like, I just, oh God, I can't remember.
But were people laughing?
Yeah, it was actually
people,
that was the
really
funniest
well.
Thing I had going for me.
Yeah, so you did really well, but you're like, oh, it was terrible. But you did, I fucking
yeah.
Loved, but you did well.
Yeah, no, I did have some really awful moments. I think I like, and you had to invite your fucking friends to
That's
them.
That's how it works.
I hated it. Oh my gosh,
so you can't bring her shows.
Yeah, so my first show ever, I did one open mic before this first show that I had to invite all of my friends to at the Comedy Store. Okay,
oh,
the
was it
first
your first show was at the Comedy Store?
Ooh, yeah.
In like the belly room upstairs?
Yes. Yeah. So that show was actually really good. I was so nervous. I got on stage. The mic thing fell apart. I didn't know what to do. And I was like,
yeah.
And like it was like instantly... funny to watch, and so people already were laughing, and so the host had to come on and help with me with the mic, which was great. But that show was great.
Yeah.
So I had all this confidence.
Yeah. You're like,
oh
my
God,
I got this cracked.
And then the main room, I think Bill Burr went on a couple people before me. Like my second show,
your second show was in the main room to a Bill Burr.
I'm trying to remember
who was trying to bang you that they put you on the main room for your second show?
They definitely did not bang me. I would not bang me after the show.
I'm saying, who was trying to bang you? Because there's no way you should be on the main room for your second show.
Well, they fucking do this. Mike Cetera, maybe, had this show.
Mark Saratella?
Mark
Saratella, not Mark Saratella.
Negative. No. I think it's a Mike. It's a Mike for sure. He makes the pancakes across the street on Sunday.
On Griddle?
yes, at the Griddle.
Okay.
Amazing.
And he has a show.
Oh
That's
my God,
Hollywood
yeah.
for you. Yeah.
But like, no, he definitely didn't try to hook up with me. I wouldn't either.
But my point is like, the main room at the Comedy Store is probably the premier show
yeah,
in the
I
world.
Yeah, I shouldn't have been there.
And this is
I
your
did
second
it, like,
time.
I think I bombed there twice. Yeah, no, it was very easy for me to get up there, but it's a bringer show. They like bring great comics,
oh,
and then
show
they also
the main room.
Yeah. No, okay. They didn't tell me. Great,
like
Dana, you're amazing.
It was like a Friday
Come
night.
Back.
It was like an off night, and they're like, bring your fucking friends, type of thing.
No, they had Bill Burr. They had amazing comics, and they also had shitty comics.
Oh, they had bringers. Okay, got it. Yeah, that makes sense. That's one model they do. They bring in their fucking
their
slam dunks, and then they sprinkle
and
it with some bringers.
You don't know who the slam dunks are until like that night.
Well, usually pretty obvious because like no one you ever heard of, and then Jerry Seinfeld.
Yeah,
Gotham comedy in New York is the same way. Yeah.
God. God, it was awful. I was awful. I like, yeah. Yeah, I was bad for, but you know, I really wanted to kind of face the fear of just performing and speaking. I felt like I had this desire to act, to perform, to be on stage, but I was always so afraid of
and you
it.
You never did that in high school or anything?
No, because I was an athlete
sports,
and I was like, hiding behind this, like, oh, I'll just do everything physical and impress everybody this way, like, for really sure. aggressive with it. But then I'm like, no, I have this, like, feminine, sensitive, performative essence to me as well, but I never was able to really yeah. express it. And so I came to LA. I was super young. And
how old are you when you came to LA?
I was like 19. 19. 18, yeah.
Okay. So you skipped college.
Well, I went to University of Delaware, and I transferred to like a theater drama school in LA.
Okay.
And right. also I was modeling at the time, and I like lived in Beverly Hills and was in this model house for a couple years. And
oh my God,
that was
model
crazy.
Houses are crazy.
Oh my God.
So tell
I
people
hated
what a model, because I dated a model. Not to brag, but I remember I went to, it was back in New York. It was, so imagine a New York model
yeah.
house.
Yeah.
Because it's almost like only one step removed from like sex trafficking.
Yeah, no,
it's,
yeah.
But it's like really, it's almost like a cam girl house, or like a porn house, where they recruit these girls to get into the porn business. And it was one room with two bunk beds. So four girls were living in this one room with one bathroom, and they were all models, and they were bunk beds.
Yeah, it was kind of, I mean, for me, it was like during Fashion Week, this agency had me come out, and I had a driver, and I had like everything sort of set up. But I did live in a room with other models that were coming from like different countries and different places in the U.S. That stayed in one room together. There were like a bunch of like beds. And that was fine. I mean, for me, I was like, whatever, I'm in LA. This is weird. This is not my
industry. But you weren't there for that long. You weren't there for like a week or two.
No, I ended up staying there because I went out for Fashion Week. And then I was like, I kind of want to stay and get into acting. I want to get into commercial. I don't want to, like, this business, I definitely don't want to be a part of, even though I was there for like the next. Yeah.
Now, I've had models on my podcast, male and female, and they both, I mean, to a person, they've all experienced severe either sexism and being assaulted on some level, or just levels of misconduct.
Yeah.
You know, from when a male model came in here, he told me a pretty harrowing story. So it just seems like there's something about the business, maybe because it's based on...
Especially back then, it was awful.
Oh, yeah.
Oh my God, this was like 10 plus years ago. Within 2 weeks, and I was 18 when I came out here, I had my agent, my driver, and the guy who owned the home like hit on me hardcore. And as like a little girl.
So you just signed with your agency, like, hey, I got an agent.
Oh, yeah.
He's like, so.
Yeah, no, he came up to he was messaging me, can I come into your room? And then the driver wasn't allowed into the model house for some reason. He like got high on ecstasy at one point and like came in the house when the owner of the house wasn't there and was like banging on my door. And I was like, put the shower on. And I was like, I'm in the bathroom. Like, I was like so afraid and I didn't know what to do. And I held my boundaries really well, but I was like afraid and I didn't want to tell my parents. And I'm like, this doesn't seem legit at all.
Yeah.
And I just, it wasn't my fucking calling in life anyways. Like, it definitely, I didn't want to be seen as that. I didn't even tell people I was modeling when I was younger because I was such an athlete and a tomboy. It was like embarrassing for me to an extent. But I also like wanted to feel beautiful at the same time. But I also felt beautiful, and I didn't realize that physical appearance was even a part of that. Like, it was like me going through this journey of being confused about how people saw beauty and then having to redefine it myself.
Yeah. Now, was your, in terms of your modeling, was it runway or just print?
I did runway for a second when I didn't eat. I was real hungry. That's how we all get eating disorders. But it was like, it was more print, and I worked a lot on the East Coast.
Yeah.
And like some on the West Coast, but more on the East Coast. I even like at 16 was doing these like pregnancy shoots where I had these like fake baby bellies like for like places in the mall, like maternity places in the mall where you like, I'm like, what the fuck am I? I'm 16 years old going out and doing maternity shoots. Like, this is fucking weird.
Yeah.
I was cast for some weird jobs, but for me, it was like exciting. It was like in the direction of where I wanted to go anyways.
For sure. So. And did you end up meeting good people and having connections
there? Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
But it was more me being like, I need to get the fuck out of this industry. This is creepy. And like, I don't want to be seen like that anyways.
Yeah. Although it's also hard when you get like approached to do modeling or to be a model, it is like someone's acknowledging you for being like an attractive person. And everyone, I don't care, like...
it's all about your heart. But like everyone wants to feel attractive at the end of the
day. But to be made for just that and to not be like seen in castings like for who you are.
Yeah.
And that's like my specialty. That was weird to me.
Yeah.
Because my personality is what's beautiful. I'm like, if people are attracted to me, that's great. But like this shit's going away and I'm not going to fucking fake that. I'm not going to try and work that, you know, to my advantage. I'm not going to get Botox. I'm not going to get fillers. I'm not going to live that life.
You're never
going
to get Botox.
No.
Never, never, never.
No, because I don't want to raise a daughter saying that this shit matters more than who you are. Like, I don't want people to, I know what that feels like, to feel like you need to like keep pretending like time doesn't exist. And I feel like so many women suffer with that, especially in this industry. And it's like, I don't want to be a part of that. I don't want to spend my time and my money thinking like, how can I reverse time? I want to live my life the way I want it and be proud of who I am and exist from that and be like, that's enough.
Yeah.
And this is beautiful. This is enough. Like I've lived it long enough to be like, I don't need to do that.
Yeah, I agree. I also think that...
P.S. All my friends get Botox, like in my family.
It's crazy,
and it's fine. It's fine.
Is it? Because I think... I feel like it's like a frog in boiling water, that whole metaphor. Like these people go, well, I'll just do a little Botox.
Right, and then
I'll get a little zhuzh in my lip. I'll get a little filler in my cheeks. Like, and next thing you know, they look like a cat person.
I know. All of my friends...
And they don't even know it. They don't even know how crazy they
look.
But
you know what? I love my friends because they do this and they also are open enough to admit that they are struggling with like this sense of worth and this idea of beauty and trying to redefine it themselves and fit into this box that is not meant to be a fucking box.
A box of their own
A box
creation,
of people,
ultimately.
Yes, yeah. But like women are so fucking influenced. Like I get it.
Yeah, it's wild.
Women are so influenced that they need to stay beautiful because that's all that they get recognized for, and that's the problem.
I mean, I guess so. I hear what you're saying. I also think that like there's enough people with enough eyeballs to be like, hey, that's enough.
Right. Well, I think people need to keep saying that.
I used to have a huge crush on Gwen Stefani. You know?
Oh, I love
Gwen Stefani.
Me too. I was like, that's the only girl I would go down on.
The only girl you would go down on?
Is that what
you
said? I mean, maybe not, but like, I thought about it, but she's amazing.
Huge crush. And I saw her in an interview recently. And like, sometimes when you smoke pot, or maybe I was on mushrooms, like, sort of. Everything kind of gets accentuated in a way where it just becomes like you really see what the fuck is going on.
Yeah.
I just remember looking at Gwen Stefani's face and I was like, how unhappy are you?
Yeah.
That you're doing this to yourself.
Right, right.
Why are you doing this to yourself? Right. Everything about your face right now is plastic. Why, why?
Because
and she's fighting the thing she wants to be, but like now all the TVs are in 4K and everything's in 4K. So you're like, look how crazy you look.
But
everyone
like we
looks
need
crazy.
To normalize being normal.
Yes.
We need to normalize what real beauty is. I'm like so sick of it. And I'm not going to be a part of it. I'm not going to be a part of it. I don't care if I'm the only fucking one that looks like I'm 80 years old when I'm 80.
No, I mean, look, I used to have such a crush on Helen Mirren. And Helen Mirren was wrinkly and old. And I was like, I'd feel
like
a prescription.
But like sexy is sexy. And like energy is sexy.
Yes.
That's the truth.
Talent is sexy.
That's the truth.
Yeah.
That's the truth. I think if people hear that more often and see that more often, that will reframe and restructure the moment we're living in where people feel like they're not enough. I think people need to talk about it more.
I guess so, because it's also like, what's the genesis of that? Like, is it chicken the egg? Because obviously you're not the first person to think that. You're not the first woman to think. We're not the first people having this conversation. So clearly people have thought like, hey, we got to take it easy with the plastic surgery. As a matter of fact, apparently this casting director, a friend of mine told me this casting director called this very famous plastic surgeon in L.A., Beverly Hills. We got a
Can
little.
Can we hold them for the helicopter?
Well, you know, it's really loud to us like we're in MASH, but on the recording it doesn't really pick up the mic.
No way. I've never heard that from anybody ever. Things I've never heard for 500, Alex.
So this casting director had to call this plastic surgeon say, you got to knock it off. Because all the women are coming in looking the exact same.
Yeah. And, oh my God, that's so funny.
And I think a lot of these women come in like, okay, this is going to keep me young. This is going to be relevant. And then people look at me like, no, you're just like an old person with surgery.
Yeah. Right. So right. That's the thing. It's like, no matter what you do, whether it's Botox or like you're shiny and you don't have expression. Like, I don't know if you're laughing or if you're smiling or if you're sad.
Oh yeah.
Like, I don't know how you feel. And I want to be able to express. Yeah. I am the most expressive person I know. I can't imagine me without expressing myself.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Like,
if you look at, there's a time, because I feel like now doctors or nurses, everyone understands Botox a little bit better now, because mm-hmm. I feel like people get Botox and they can have it selectively and their foreheads can move and shit like that. But there was a time, I'm telling you, from like, because I remember I was out of graduate school and I was like trying to watch every movie I could to kind of like learn the craft of acting. It was like from 2000 to 2006 or something, like watched performances from women. It was crazy, the amount of Botox.
Wow.
Because it was before people realized, like, oh, it's actually not cool to have a forehead that doesn't move. There's still some people who are like that, but I think they've modulated a little bit. But like, you see a movie like Cold Mountain.
Yeah.
Hey,
yeah.
It's cold. Your forehead's going to furrow.
Yeah.
Completely flat.
God.
Fucking Nicole Kidman, the other.
It's what, so other weird chick, to me. Yeah, I like my forehead. I love my forehead. I really like. I think it's so much deeper though than like wanting to resuscitate the lines or the shape of your face. It's so much more than that. It's like, hey, doctors, you shouldn't be doing this. But it's also like,
yeah,
how can we navigate our perception on beauty?
Well, also, like you said, these other cultures where they like emulate and they raise up elders.
Yeah,
like being old is good. Experience and age is good. Those wrinkles show experience.
Yes, and that should be, and like, that's something
celebrated
to brag about.
Yes.
Seriously.
As opposed to like in LA, it's like, ugh, look at that old
Yeah,
fuck.
And that's so true. Yeah. That's why I'm doing this fucking show.
Yes.
Yes. The wisdom and the beauty in aging. It's like, yeah, it's timeless.
Yeah. Yeah.
Beauty is timeless. And I don't ever, yeah.
I think it all amounts to, at the end, like most things, it's like a fear of death. Like,
yeah.
Some sort of weird.
Yeah, it's your how you perceive time too. Because if you're actually not living your life and respecting your time and how you spend your time, then suddenly like you see that your time has gone by. I feel like, and it's almost.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, because if you really live a life according to like your integrity and your purpose and you're staying true to yourself and your path, I don't think you're going to want to change anything because you're so busy on this level of just pure joy and bliss for living and breathing in a state of gratitude. And if you're really there, are you really going to sit and judge yourself and critique yourself and tell yourself that you should be a different way physically? Or are you just going to embrace it knowing that you've lived your life the way that you've wanted to?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's nothing to change in that realm of existing.
Yeah.
And shit, I'm not there. Like I'm still trying to figure it out. But I want to be in that place.
Now we're gonna go.
Scoop.
Couples Christmas retreat. Now we're caught up. Couples Christmas. So you get cast in this movie. Couple.
Yeah.
A lead role.
Yeah. Yeah.
Role.
Yeah.
Have you done lead role in feature films before?
Oh God, yeah, the ones that I'm not proud of. I have, but this was funny. I feel like I was the only person that auditioned multiple.
Yeah, you said you auditioned
multiple times.
It was just hilarious.
And it was so fun because I did it with my parents, and I was like laughing the whole time with my parents. I have a friend, Christian, who's a cinematographer. He's amazing and he's really talented. He told me that he was filming this movie in Baltimore, and I was like, "You should see if like there's an extra part for me." And he asked. And they were still looking for one of the lead roles, and they wanted her to be ethnic. They wanted her to be either Latina or African American, and they could not find the right person. And I was like, Christian, you never know until you hear someone read.
Yeah.
And I was like, tell them that. And so they had me audition a bunch of times. And I ended up getting it. And what's crazy is I didn't think I got it. And I had a flight and I couldn't exchange my flight. I ended up leaving my wallet as I'm going to my flight at 6 a.m. with my mom. I was like, I didn't know if I got it. I'm like, oh, this sucks. But I want to get my flight back to LA because I have shit going on in my life. Like, I'm not going to wait around for the Christmas couples retreat.
Yeah.
So then I left my wallet on my bed at home and I get back. And the next day I find out I got the role, which is amazing. So yeah, I got this lead. It was really supposed to be like an uptight girl with a stick up her ass in this perfect relationship. And I really gave them no other option but to cast this girl that is goofy as fuck. I literally gave them, the director would sometimes be like, take it down 300%, Matt.
Yeah.
But I had so much fun redefining the role of my person. It was a fucking blast. Yeah. And like nobody told me to stop.
Yeah,
I'm like, I'm going to make her interesting. This movie, the way that, from the very beginning, I'm like, we have to rewrite this. We have to rewrite. And then everybody would jump on board, which was nice.
Yeah.
Like, and great. There were so many writers. And to be there from like the first day, everything was very by the book. And so for me to come in and be like, but I think I should say this. And I literally, like, my line was so bad that I was like, what if I went potato, potato instead? And they were like, brilliant.
Love it. That's great.
I'm like, thank God, because I'm not going to say this shit that does not make sense just to anybody.
Yeah.
Yeah, no.
I mean, you know, a lot of these movies, it's a holiday, like basically a holiday Hallmark
movie.
They want to pitch it to all those.
Yeah, the Faith Channel. Yes.
Everyone's very religious. Of course, I came up with a brilliant idea during the filming of this because I think it was inspired by this movie. I was like, how great would that be to do like a hump and everyone's playing like super sincere. They're drinking their cocoa.
I don't
know about Jim. He's not talking to me and blah, blah, blah. But what if we lose the Airbnb? What if we lose the bed and breakfast because of the investors coming in, you know, whatever the fuck it is. And then all of a sudden they walk into a room and someone's got their throat slashed. It becomes a slasher flick. A slasher fic. Born out of a Hallmark movie, and the rest of the fucking movie, you juxtapose like dead bodies and like people with their fucking cocoa. I think that would be fucking great.
Wow, what a plot twist. I did not hear that until right now.
Maybe because I wanted to murder everyone on that fucking set.
Yeah, right.
Like, what if Vincent just ended up dead? I mean, come on. That'd be a twist. You would expect it. It's so funny because after it was done, I was like, I don't want to put this. Yeah, I got them for you. So you, anyway.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
I don't care.
We're having this is sponsored by Booch Craft. Booch and Craft.
Cooch Craft.
Cooch Craft.
Cooch chugged.
But there were talented people there. They were really fun people, and everyone kind of was like really cool to hang out with.
Yeah, no,
but
it was like, a blast.
Something about the
being on set.
The cohesion of everyone together was creating fucking
situation. You were there during a really difficult time, and you actually helped shift all of it because you and I had that conversation. Remember when we got really high together and we talked about, you brought up what everybody was thinking about one of the people on set who was like, quiet on the set. And I was having serious issues not saying anything to him directly.
Yeah.
And instead saying things on set like, don't steal my joy, you joy thief. Dream squasher. But I didn't say anything to him directly, and I felt like that's not being in integrity. Like, I just need to say something to him. And so you brought it up, and you were like, well, what if you said it this way? And I was like, oh, noted. Look at that.
And then he was great the rest of the shoot after you did that. He really was, yeah.
He was wonderful.
Awesome.
And so, but that shifted, I feel like, the whole set, everything on set.
Yeah.
And so you came in at a time where I think they were like, we need to, like, chill everybody out and, like, get everybody quiet. But it was just so intense. And it's really just the ability to communicate.
The thing that made me, like, so I'm there for, and maybe I'm a bit of a diva, who knows, but I'm being used as background basically for this movie. And I was like, oh, okay, it's fine. I'm just hanging out with Callie. It's cool. But at one point I had like a fucking, I don't know, like a bag of chips or something like that.
Oh, shut up.
And I was
up.
Like, and they weren't even shooting. It wasn't like roll sound. It was like a bag of chips. They were between shots. I opened, you know, the sound of the tinfoil.
Somebody.
Quiet, please. Like, he looked over and I was like,
who?
Our AD. Yeah, you know, he looked over like quietly, like stared at me, and I kind of snapped. I didn't snap.
I would too, but a little bit.
I said, I'm a fucking professional.
Yeah.
Don't talk to me like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And everyone around me went, ooh, like, I can't believe he talked back. And I'm like, I don't give a shit. Like, what is he gonna do? Fire me for opening a bag?
Right before they even.
And they weren't if they were shooting and they would roll sound, I get it. But they weren't even doing that. It was between takes.
Yeah. right.
in the middle of the day. So right. I'm kind of like, okay, there's something wrong here.
Yeah.
And ultimately,
right,
it wasn't
right.
his fault. He thinks he's doing his job.
Exactly.
But there's no one there to tell him, like, yeah. you can pull it back.
Yes, you know? Yes. You love your job. You love doing a good job, but do it differently. And I talked to him in a way where Christina was right next to me, and she was like, I really love the way you just communicated
oh, wow.
that.
Very cool.
And I was like, well, thanks to Bill. Who would have thought? Who would have thought?
Who would have thought that fucking derelict would have a good idea? But he did.
But it did. But yeah, that was the truth, so thank you.
You know, listen, we will reconnect when this film is done.
We'll have a screening
party. We'll have to smoke
party.
Some weed.
So much weed.
Mushrooms.
Oh my God. You have no idea how much.
I just hope they keep in my veiled sexual comment where
I hope
come in the room
so.
With Callie, who plays my wife in it, and I go, I'm like, wow, was that coconut oil organic? Oh, anyway, sorry we're late. You know, just a small
no,
little,
I
like,
think
nugget.
They will because I hope
choice.
It was the same take because you did it twice and the second take was great. I'm not sure if that was the same one that you said this in, but you were like, oh, it was a great story. And then she cut you off or whoever the other lead was. But that was my favorite take. I hope you said it before that.
I don't remember.
Because it was awesome.
But it would just be fun to be like, okay, this movie is going to be really
ridiculous.
Silly. But check this part out.
Yeah. I mean, I honestly, the actors are so amazing in it.
Yeah,
like everybody
fun.
Who we worked with.
Everyone's good looking
yeah,
and talented.
Yeah.
So,
I missed out. They went to Sundance. I was invited to sit on a panel with them for like women in film.
Wait, who was them?
Vincent, the other lead women in the movie.
They were at Sundance
yeah,
at
they
a panel?
Were, yes.
What?
I know. I was invited. I was pitching my show. But
for this movie?
Yeah. No, not for this movie specifically, but Vincent knows people.
Vincent
I'm telling you.
Vincent knows people. It's
he
incredible.
He seriously knows people. Yeah.
Vincent DePaul, man.
Yeah.
That guy. I love
he's,
him.
He's wonderful.
Well, listen, thanks for coming. You've been
awesome. This has
been
a lot of
I could talk to
fun.
You forever about
everything. Forever, forever. Thank you.
And maybe we'll
thank
do a
you.
Comedy show some.
Yeah.
Together,
let's
you know?
Please.
That'll be fun.
Yes. Yes.
But thanks for coming. And where can people find you, Dana Mae Jameson?
People can find me at my Instagram. At Dana Mae, DanaMayy, two Ys. And my website. This is so funny. I never like hype
plug
myself
yourself.
Up. Yeah, I really never do. Okay, so DanaMayJameson.com. I told you how to spell Jameson before, everybody. Jamison. Okay, thank you.
All right, bye guys.
That's-